When we talk about guns, we're usually talking about safety. But what makes you feel safe or unsafe, protected or not, is complicated. It's going to depend a lot on who you are, where you live, what your day-to-day reality looks like. And that's kind of the crux of Nathan Lewis Jackson's new play, Brother Toad, at the KC Rep. I'm Gina Kaufman. Nathan's here with me now to talk about that play and what inspired it to kick off our Friday art show on KCUR's Central Standard. Hi, Nathan.
How's it going?
Good. How are you?
I'm okay. Nice day. I'm all right.
Yeah. So, quick synopsis of the play.
It surrounds two men who are, they're both related, but they're going down different paths, and each path ends with the decision of, how do I protect myself and the ones I love?
Why is it called Brother Toad?
It's called Brother Toad originally, and you'll see when you see the play, because I know everyone will come see the play, hopefully. It is, if you know the Uncle Remus stories and the Brer Rabbits and the Brer Bears, a lot of these stories were told to, it started off, you know, parents telling slave children these stories to help them survive in that world. And now, even though we're done with slavery, we still have to tell young black men, young black children, some stories, different stories, to help them survive in the world that we live in now. So it's kind of a play off of that, and deals with some of the lessons that we are still taught even today.
So do you see this play as something that could teach those lessons or start that conversation?
Yeah, I think it's different in the black community, but it's across the board in America, there are lessons that we're learning every day about how to stay safe. And I think the play touches on that and deals with that. And there are lessons that can be taught.
So take me back to the moment when this particular idea for this play and the relationship at the heart of it started kicking around in your mind. What was going on?
It was actually my children were a big pull. And I remember the stories that my mother taught me and the lessons she taught me. You know, if we walked into a department store with our hands in our pocket, we were going to hear or get a talking to. And things like that, things like who we hang out with, where we go at night, those things were taught. And a lot of those lessons I was frustrated with growing up, because I'm thinking my mother's, she's from the 60s, you know, we don't have to worry about this stuff anymore. And as I got older, I realized that's not the case. And as this, you know, modern day comes on, you got social media, and we see it's not just, you know, folks saying this is what's happening. We're actually seeing it every day. And then I had my children, I had my son, and I'm looking at him and I'm thinking, was my mama right? I'm going to have to tell whatever versions and whatever stories to my child to keep him safe.
When you say we see it on social media every day, can you say what it is?
We see, to a certain degree, we see how guns affect and how violence affects our society. I feel like I want to be more specific, but I just want to say guns in general, because that's a huge thing. And it is not necessarily always in the sense of negatively, but how do guns affect our society? Every day we see it. And I think, again, it's different for each community. I think it's different for America as a whole, but then when you break it down and we're either talking about the gay community, you're talking about the black community, you're talking about the Islamic community, everybody deals with that subject differently.
The subject of guns or the subject of safety?
The subject of safety, we'll say. Guns play into that. It's hard to have one without the other. But essentially, we're all looking for safety. We're all looking just to protect ourselves and protect the ones that we care about. But when you're here in America, it is impossible to have that conversation of safety and protection without getting into guns and Second Amendment rights.
So when you say that your children were a really big pull for you to do a play about this, mm-hmm. where did, as you first started thinking about that, did you start with something you wanted them to know, or did you start with characters and, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean. I always try to start with characters. And not have a play that's just all about the issue. And the characters, both of the main characters we're looking at are versions of me. Maybe one is me when I was younger, one is me now. And I tried to start with that, and I tried to start with how I feel and how I felt when I think about these things, and how I feel when I look at my child and I have to say to myself, okay, I have to be not only a a father and be a provider, I'd have to be a protector as well. And how am I going to protect my child?
So let's start with the you who is the younger Nathan Lewis Jackson, who inspired one of these characters.
Yes.
You say you're remembering what you felt back then, what you thought about when it came to guns and safety and all of these things. Can you take me back to, I know you don't want to spoil too much about the play, but take me back to the you who this is based on.
Yeah. I think some of the similarities would be when I, again, I grew up in a part of, I grew up in Kansas City, Kansas, Wyandotte County, around the Quindaro area, and guns for me meant one thing.
What?
They meant these are bad things you shouldn't have, and if you have one, it's going to quickly lead to your demise.
How? But can you flesh that out? How would having a gun lead to your demise in that particular
context? In that particular context, and just in that neighborhood, guns, anyone who had them, normally that's what happened. Either you were killed or you killed someone. It wasn't a protection kind of a thing. There were different things you did in the neighborhood for protection. Everyone I ever knew that had a gun growing up in that neighborhood they ended poorly. I had family members, whether it be family members or friends, most of those guys, it went a certain way. And it normally was a negative way. Either you were killed or you killed someone. So there was, and even though they weren't talking about some of the issues with how, maybe we were talking about it, I was a kid and I didn't get it, how you're viewed as an African-American man, you're already viewed as this dangerous thing sometimes. Now you add a gun onto that, that can't help you. So I think that's how I grew up viewing guns and viewing safety. And as I got older, that changed. It's continued to change. But there was about that time in my life when, soon before I got out of high school, that I started looking at it just a little bit differently. It took time, but I started looking at it a little differently and started wondering, I guess, looking at all the nuances of that, not just how I grew up viewing it.
What made you start looking at it differently?
Getting out, the first thing was just getting out of the neighborhood and meeting other people, meeting other guys, whether it be whatever race those guys were or whatever race these people were, who did have guns but didn't view them like I did. For me, it was like a duh, this is how everybody looks at it. And then when I got out of my environment and started meeting more people, I saw that not everybody views the situation the same.
You know, a few weeks ago, you participated in a storytelling event that KCUR put on at the Record Bar, and the theme was road trips. But you told a story that was also kind of kicking around in your mind as part of this story that you're telling at the Rep. Can you share that story with our listeners?
Was that the one about the
in the
was
desert?
That the Cali? Yeah, the desert, which kind of has to do with that. Yeah, so I was in the desert. I was traveling from California, long trip from California to Kansas at the time. I had my family in the car, and I'm driving.
This is grown-up Nathan.
This is grown-up Nathan.
But
sometimes I don't feel like, every year it feels like the guy I was before wasn't grown-up, and I think I'm grown-up now, but I'm
Fair
probably
enough.
Not. Maybe, what, 5 years ago, maybe 6 years ago, and we were traveling, and I get a flat tire in the desert, and the only place that was available at the time was this little shack. Like, it was Sunday. It was late. No one should have been open.
In the desert.
It's in the desert. And I changed the tire, so I got a spare on it. I got a donut on there. But this thing's, you're not supposed to drive a donut for very long. So this thing is about to give. I don't know when it's going to give. And if that goes out, then I'm really in trouble. So I find this little spot off the highway. And I go to it, but again, you know, the family's in the car. And my daughter's, what is she, three or four at the time. And the guys, when I pull up, I'm already weird about it. And then I pull up and see these guys who, to me, look a little sketchy.
What about them looks sketchy to you?
Well, one, just growing up as my mother's child, it was all white guys. So, my mother always warned you to be careful about, you know, you got to be careful when you're off somewhere. And, you know, she grew up in Mississippi. So, if you're off in the middle of nowhere and you encounter a bunch of white guys, you know, for her, and again, she raised me, that's a scary, you got to be careful. And there was this one-eyed dog, or this weird-looking dog. I could see guns in the background of this, like, garage that they were working out of. And it felt a little uncomfortable.
So, at that moment, I guess when When you describe how you thought about guns growing up mm-hmm. and what you do and don't do for protection, what is and isn't going to help you, mm-hmm. in that moment, did you think about it differently? Did you think that a gun might have helped you, or did you still have that idea
at that moment? No, at that moment, I didn't think about it. At that moment, everything went. I hadn't made the flip of, wait a minute, could a gun help me in this situation? That moment is all about me and my family. It's all about the people I want to protect. That's what it was about. And my way of protecting them at the time was, I'm going to get out the car. Just, you know, if something happens, this is what we're going to do. Call Papa, call these people. I'm going to lock the door. Like, it was.
You made a contingency plan.
Yes. It wasn't about, it was a different, it's what I was raised to do by my mother.
And did that have to do in part with the fact that you saw guns?
Yes, that was part of it. That was part of it. It was several different things. Even the old crazy one-eyed dog, because I'm not a huge fan of dogs. But the guns definitely had something to do with it. But I saw the gun. I didn't see the guns until after I got out of the car. What I'd already made it, just the guns took it to a new level. And I think why the guns take it to another level is, when you don't have a gun, is that's just a... It's I take martial arts now. And I was in a martial arts class for maybe a few months, and I asked our instructor, I said, hey, do you have like moves for like guns if somebody pulls a gun off me? She was like, no, not really. These is not guns are a game changer. You know, when we were thinking of these martial arts and how to fight someone hand on hand, they weren't thinking about these types of weapons. And I think that's what guns do. Guns are just that they take things to a different level. There's not much you can do against a gun if you don't have a gun.
So your play is centered around a relationship between two men and their different trajectories in life. Mm-hmm. Why did you want to approach this topic of guns in that way, rather than having a central character?
I think I wanted to show a couple different reasons. One, I think it was a generational thing. And when I started talking about guns, just the way we think about them is different depending on our ages, and I wanted to get both of those in. And also, they are economically, it's a different thing. One lives where I grew up, over in Wyandotte County, and one lives in Johnson County, which is kind of me. I grew up in one, and I live in another, and I realized the attitudes of both are different. So I wanted to get both of those perspectives.
Can you tell me more about the Johnson County perspective as you see it?
When it comes to guns,
yeah.
This is just what I've gathered. Again, it's the same. It's when I'm in Wyandotte County, the idea of having a gun is crazy. In Johnson County, it's not. There are people I've seen my neighbors walking it out, not a lot, but I've seen it before with a weapon, and it's not that big of a deal. The people I talk to there, for a lot of them, that's just a way of life. That's how you protect yourself. It's as basic as getting a smoke detector or locks on your door. It's just another way to protect yourself. And with that piece of protection, most of the people I know that are from that area feel safer, as opposed to Wyandotte County. When you get that piece, it's sometimes difficult to feel safer.
You know, you wrote this play thinking about your kids. Have they seen it? Have they?
Actually, they have. I have a 5-year-old and a 10-year-old. They've seen it kind of by accident, because I still parent, and there were days I couldn't get a babysitter. So both of them have come with me, because they've seen theater since they were very small, and they can sit through it and watch. But both of them have seen it. My 5-year-old is, you know, he's just kind of watching. Listen to people say stuff, and he doesn't quite get it, or he hasn't expressed that. My daughter, who is very interested in it and wants to see it again, she gets it, and she understands some of the language, and she understands. She asks questions about that after we see her. She says, "Oh, it was a question about what did she say? Something about why people have guns or some of the laws about guns." She's curious.
Did anything she saw in the play surprise you?
That she's, oh, Wow, geez. Yeah, I say language because that was one of the things that we doted upon was the it was almost a difference in how people speak, I think, surprised her. Because as I'm doing the play, I try to adjust the way some of the characters talk. One particular character who's from Wyandotte County says different things and speaks a little differently. This one particular, not all of them, but just one particular character says some things that I'm used to because I'm from Wyandotte County. My daughter's not. So she was more, almost more questions about like his lingo.
Huh. So did you, when you think about, I mean, having a play where two characters are essentially you at different times in your life, is that an odd experience for you just watching?
I think it's an odder experience writing it because you're into it more when you're writing it. As we're watching it, it's a separation that I can do so I can then go back and do rewrites. I got to step away from it a little bit. And look at it with a different eye. In writing it, it's actually a very rewarding therapeutic experience to get some of that stuff out and finding out things about yourself. You know, we all act like we know ourselves. We don't. And this is a way that I actually got to know a little bit more about myself.
How do you, when you think about the possible audiences for this play, is there an audience that you really hope will come?
No, I think we're very split. I think we've all realized this. We've been split for a long time, but the nation,
Americans,
and even this city. I say America as a whole, but this definitely the city. We're split on everything. We're definitely split on guns. So I would not want to have. It feels like you're coming from one or the other side, and I would like for both sides to be able to watch this play and say, "Wait a minute. This is not. I am not giving my praise to one side or the other. That's not what I'm doing. I think we're just breaking this down, looking at it, because that's what we need to do in the end, is both sides just want to be safe. They just want protection. It's just they go different ways of getting it. And to understand why each side has chosen what they've chosen, and is there a way for us all to feel safe? Because that's what it comes down to. When one person's safety gets in the way of another person's safety, that's when I have a little bit of a problem.
Well, Nathan Lewis Jackson, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
Nathan's play, Brother Toad, is at the Rep through May 27th, and you can get more information about showtimes, all that kind of thing, at kcrep.org. Up next on Central Standard, Kansas City's doo-wop rapper, two things I never imagined I would say together in my wildest dreams. Stay tuned. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman, and it's the first Friday of the month, which means it's an art show on KCUR's Central Standard. Our next guest has entered NPR's Tiny Desk Contest here in town, which culminates in a Best of Kansas City show concert tomorrow at the Beer Station. His name is Joe Stanziola, and his band is called Secondhand King. He calls himself a doo-wop rapper. So in case you're wondering what that sounds like, here's a song that pretty well explains it.
I wish I was born in the 50s, singing in an old-time doo-wop group about love and about everything I shouldn't be. I know I shouldn't sing, but I do it anyway, cause I don't believe in reality. It means nothing to me, and I'm happy that way. And Mama said, show you grounded again, when Connor came over drunk, falling into his trench. A bottle of whiskey straight to the dome, scared to death because his fate was unknown. His dad was a druggie, it got ugly. He thought, maybe this will get him to love me. Kids from my school never learned about heart. I had to watch it fall apart before I could start my real life. I wish I was born in the 50s, singing in an old-time doo-wop group about love and about everything I shouldn't be. I know I should.
This is Joe Stanziola, the Secondhand King, Kansas City's doo-wop rapper. Hi, Joe.
Hi.
This is catchy as hell. I've had it stuck in my head since yesterday afternoon.
Thank you. That's what I'm going for.
Define doo-wop rap.
Doo-wop rap is... Doo-wop rap is I use doo-wop as like sort of like a guiding light for my rap. So... It's the soul of like doo-wop and like the happy-go-lucky-ness mixed with the poetic nature of hip-hop, essentially.
And some of the rhythmic qualities of hip-hop.
Yes. very much, it's very much so hip hop. Yeah.
It's not really uncommon for someone your age to be into rap, but doo-wop is a little more unexpected. How did you get into doo-wop?
So I think it was just like finding myself as a person a little bit, because like I really relate to Buddy Holly very.
What very about him?
I don't know. It's just who he is. Like, he's kind of like a cheeseball sort of guy who just like, hey, I'm Buddy Holly. Like, that's.
You relate to that?
Yeah. I think it's just like the feeling that he doesn't take himself too seriously. And he is sort of like he gets his heart broken, and he married his wife the first date he went on, and that is very Italian of him.
And I'm guessing from your last name and the fact that you made that comment that you're Italian?
I am. Stanziola.
And so, and that's an important part of your love for doo-wop, is it?
I don't know if that directly correlates. And I'm only like a quarter Italian, so I can barely even claim it. But I would say that I like to say that there's that people that Italians, and I think everyone in the whole entire universe, sometimes they get a thunderbolt, like you see somebody and you get like your heart just sort of like hits. And that's
the movie Moonstruck is what you're talking about.
I haven't seen that, but it sounds
you
like...
You should. It's really good.
Is it romantic?
It's ridiculous. But if you like things that are like cheese ball, but also so good...
Yes,
it's perfect.
That's my life.
Okay, but doo-wop is what exactly? Guys from the 1950s dressed alike with hair greased back, singing harmonies?
Yeah. I mean, for me, I've always sort of been like a little bit of a loner. And... that has changed since I've gotten the band, but I think initially it was just me, so it was like, okay, I would like that song goes. I would much rather, if I could, and if I could find people that were like-minded, I would just start a doo-wop cover band. But that's not, that sort of sells it short a little bit. And I think like finding that in myself to where I can like get like six different voices that are sort of like happy-go-lucky and get the soul of doo-wop, and then eventually everything will sort of fall into place is the answer. I don't know.
What gave you the idea to combine the sound of doo-wop with rap?
I would say I don't think I had a choice, because I heard the song The Duke of Earl by Gene Chandler. And it was like this like aha moment when I was, I don't know, 20 years old, sort of just like making rap. And
I haven't thought about that song in a long time.
Well, I think it should come back. It's an important song. I don't know.
What about it? What do you like about it? I mean, well, this was a huge epiphany for you. Why?
The when I heard that song, just the just the steady build, and then Gene Chandler just like jumping in, and as I walk through this world, and it was like this, oh my, like how can I have that, because that's what I know I want. And that's one of those moments where there's a word for it that the English definition hasn't found yet, but that's who I need to be.
Aw. And then, but then the rap part, you don't have a choice but to combine that feeling you had with, to express it somehow in a way that involves rap.
Yeah, I'm like a bird that thinks it's a duck. I'm like a robin that thinks it's a duck or something. So how does a robin that wants to hang out with ducks, maybe.
Explain.
Like, I'm a rapper. I am at my core. Rap was my first love. When I just had come out of the womb, my two parents, who were from Vermont and Iowa, and they, you know, they have no correlation to rap, but as soon as I got out of the womb, they started playing. They wrote a rap poem for me. And I don't
they were just inspired by your birth.
Yeah.
To start rapping?
In Kansas. And there was no correlation. It was 1989. and it just like happened. And I think ever since then, I've just been stuck on this whole rap thing.
So you grew up listening to rap, not just your parents rapping, I'm guessing.
No, they are horrible rappers.
But you love other things about them?
Yeah, sure. They're great.
Okay, but so you, in combining these two things, we'll talk about it more, but maybe we should listen some more too. I want to play a song, King of Broken Hearts. And I know this isn't like really your current hit of the moment, and we'll talk about that song. But this one to me captures this doo-wop rap hybrid so clearly. The song is The King of Broken Hearts. Let's listen.
She wears yoga pants and skirts so many that when she flirts, damn, sure does tempt me, but I'm a good guy, I say to myself, as if it'll stop me from these feelings I felt. And when she smiles, my heart does melt. I don't know about you, but I'm sure I'm going to hell. I think she's Lucifer in the flesh. She claims I'm seducing her, I digress. And if you don't believe me, you should take some time out and see this girl in a sundress. You drive me insane, I shouldn't complain, but you play these mind games and make me want to step in front of a train. I'd rather swim in a river of rejection than deal with this type of depression. You're killing me.
I'm the king of broken hearts, I destroy things.
Joe Stanziola, Secondhand King, this song is so interesting to me rhythmically.
Thank
really,
you.
Like, because there are, I feel like there, when you talk about doo-wop rap, they are really both right there on top of each other, two different rhythmic patterns.
Yes.
Talk about it.
So I think just by listening to so much doo-wop, I've forced myself to be influenced. So it's like a Clockwork Orange when you're in the movie theater and your eyes are open and you're just being fed this whatever. I don't know.
But you did this to yourself.
I did this to myself, yeah. This was no one else's doing but my own. But I think by like doing that so much, I just sort of had no choice but to find the melody and just staying true. So it just feels like, me, I guess. I don't know.
Did you struggle to figure out how to put these two things together? Because I never would have imagined how cool it sounds, honestly,
thank
to
you.
Have those two different things going on together.
Yeah, I think I definitely think if you would have heard the first song, because like I've been trying to get this right for about like 6 years, and this song, this album that I have coming out June 8th, is like my coming out as full doo-wop rap. if that's the right terminology for, I don't know, but. So
when you say coming out, I mean, is this like hard to admit to people?
I don't know if it's hard to admit, but I think it's been like I feel like the dog. I'm quoting a lot of movies today.
Also making a lot of metaphors.
Yeah. I'm just really abstract and really unique. I'm just kidding. I'm sorry. But that, I would say, it's like, you know, I'm on this big mission, Lord of the Rings. Maybe. I don't know. I need to stop. stop quoting things. But it's just like, I don't know. It's just trying to find the depth and it, like, I felt like I couldn't disappoint doo-wop. And I have a really big respect for doo-wop. When I first started trying to do this, I emailed the managers of the Drifters and the Platters and all these people, and was like, hey, I really want to do this. here's sort of what I'm doing, and it wasn't very good. And they were like, all right, whatever. So, and my goal was to like open for them on tour or something. But so saying that, like having this album come out, I'm very anxious about it because this is like me.
Yeah, so, that's really cool.
Thank you.
Well, so how did you get started as a musician?
I was 16 and like I had a pretty sort of just a rough high school sort of go of it. Cause like, you know, even in third grade, I was diagnosed with ADD. And I think just since then, and both my parents were very academically gifted, and both of them like went to really nice schools and they were just really on it. And I just couldn't figure out why. I mean, I just wasn't interested. And I think the moment I heard Tupac, I was like, that was the first aha moment of like, oh, okay, so I'm probably not going to be an NBA player when I grow up. So this is like, this is me. This is who I want to be. And just the emotion and the passion that he has for music.
You know, a lot of, I mean, it might not be totally self-evident why, like, a white kid in Kansas City hears Tupac and says, that's me. Can you explain that a little more?
Yeah, I mean, there's a song that Tupac has on one of his, like secret tapes. It's called My Burning Heart, and I can probably still recite the whole thing. Like, it's just this, like, really passionate, like, really, like, I lay awake tonight because I want to be with you. If you were beside me, I flavorly kiss you. Each time I see you, like, it's just this, like, really simple, like, this, like, storyline and this really poetic feeling that I probably listened to a million times over. And then I would play his other music, and, like, I think that's the good thing about music is that the struggle is universal. I mean, you have, like, back in the day, I'm a really big fan of jazz, too, and jazz guys. Back when America was in such a turmoil, like, every race, every color, every creed could come to New York and 1 a.m. when everybody left, you could all join forces and make music, so.
When you talk about having a hard time as a kid growing up, and just especially in high school when you were 16, mm-hmm. music enters the equation. What did that have to do with this?
Well, I sort of like, I had a really hard time connecting with people that I felt like were like me. And I just felt like, okay, so I don't feel like there's a lot of people that understand what I'm going through right now. And maybe that was selfish. And so, but at the same token, that's just.
Most teenagers think that.
Yeah. Like you know, I think a lot of people feel that way, but at the same time, I needed something that connected me and made me know that it was okay to be myself. And I think that was the first time when I started creating raps instead of listening to my teachers that I was connected into being myself.
As you've grown up and gotten past that high school phase, has Kansas City been a good place to cut your teeth?
I think so. Kansas City is a great training ground. And at the same token, it can be a struggle just because we're in the heart of everything. But at the same time, we're not like Chicago. We're not an A city. So sometimes, and I have a song on the new album that is called New York, which is like my affinity for New York and like going to New York, but at the same time, like loving Kansas City. And I think a lot of Kansas City artists can atone that not too many people make it out of Kansas City, which is, it's hard, you know?
Well, is that your goal, to make it beyond Kansas City, to get out there and take this somewhere else?
Well, I think you have to. I mean, if you want to make it a career, you have to. And I love the city. I love everything about the city. But I think to really go somewhere, you got to go to like New York or LA, or at least like connect there for 3 years.
Well, okay.
I don't know. I'm sorry. This is a. If you're listening, don't listen to your teachers and move.
Well, before we go, I want to play one last song, and we're going to hear it in a second, but there's a video that goes with it, and it's clearly shot over on the west side. It's Go So Wrong, and it is much less doo-wop sounding, and also less like, I mean, I don't really hear a lot of rap. It's very indie poppy.
Yeah, I like to think it's Broadway.
Broadway
inspired.
Talk to me about this.
So I've lately gotten into concept records a lot, and sort of Frankie is like a Broadway. In a perfect world, it would be a Broadway play, and I'm a really big fan of just the idea of Broadway plays, and just concept records in general, and it just kind of made sense. I don't know.
Well, Joe Stanziola, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thanks for having me.
Joe will perform as Secondhand King at NPR's Tiny Desk Contest, the Best of Casey show. That showcase of local bands starts at 4 and lasts till 10 tomorrow at the Beer Station in Waldo. For details, go to kcur.org/tinydesk. I'm Gina Kaufman, back in a minute. So where do we go? So the Kentucky Derby is this weekend, and there are lots of watch parties where fun hats and other forms of derby attire are highly encouraged. So we're ending today's show on KCUR's Central Standard with advice on dressing for the Derby and also a little history. I'm Gina Kaufman, here with Andrew Gabler. He's a fashion enthusiast who sells vintage clothing at the River Market Antique Mall, and he'll be judging a Best Dressed contest at the Kansas City Museum's Derby Party tomorrow at 3. Andrew, hi.
Hi.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, can we start with why and how the Kentucky Derby has become a total excuse for people everywhere, whether they like horse racing or not, to wear big hats and drink mint juleps?
Sure. It's a really fun event to get out and enjoy the race and show off your finery and get really dolled up. So, yeah, it's a really, really good reason.
What is the Derby fashion statement kind of referencing, though? Is it historical, regional? Does it have anything to do with horses?
Well, it's very good luck to wear a hat for the horses. So it's really for the horses and good luck for them to win.
That's how it originated?
Yes.
So how has Derby fashion changed over the years?
You know, with the times, fashion's always changing. And, but it's always fun to show off your own personal taste. So, probably we'll see a lot of floral and fun and spring fashion tomorrow because finally we have spring weather. So, yeah.
So take me back though to the early days of the Derby and the fashions that people might have seen then and kind of, yeah, that storyline kind of.
Well, I did a little tiny bit of research last night, and it wasn't until I think the 60s when the hats got a little bit bigger and a little bit more playful with the advent of being televised. So before then, of course, what was in fashion was of the times. But the fashion has evolved as life does. So now we have very big, beautiful hats that celebrate the Derby and definitely an homage to every Southern belle inside of all of us.
Well, so what are some of the common missteps, if you could be so bold, for people who go most of the year in like jeans or whatever, and then they go to dress up for this Derby party and something just isn't right?
Well, you know, you have to wear whatever you're comfortable in, but it definitely is every reason to get all dolled up. I was reading last night, and the dress code was morning wear. So you would wear your finest clothes, hats, gloves, and a parasol to shade yourself. And that tradition has still maintained that you want to look your best. It's a social event, and everyone will be there. But definitely the intent was to gain attention by engaging the elite. So that's a little bit of the history.
Can you explain
in my
that a
limited
little bit?
Reference. Initially, they wanted women to participate, and it was gambling and drinking, which was not necessarily a pull for women. So they engaged them by having picnics, and women came in their best dressed. So that was initially the pull, was to engage
to bring an audience of women to the Kentucky Derby.
Yeah.
Well, what do you like about this particular look that people are going for on Derby Day?
Oh, I always enjoy seeing whatever anyone presents themselves fashion-wise. I love seeing everyone's personal taste and aesthetic, no matter what the event. I love watching people every day. So not only for events, but just in everyday life, I think it's really fun to see what people wear. But this event is really fun to me because I have a lot of friends. So along with myself, it will be April Madden and Donna Folk, and we will all be judging together. So we have a really fun event to participate in together. And also, Paul Gutierrez is such a wonderful person there at the museum that is so wonderful at engaging everyone in activity and bringing the community together to celebrate the day.
Well, so getting back to the derby look, though, so the elements of it, you've kind of named gloves, hats, parasols, but the hat is the big deal. But
yeah.
So talk to me about each element. As someone who collects and sells vintage clothing, what makes one hat stand out from another, and how do you match that hat with the right outfit?
Well, I did read a little article last night talking about, do you choose your hat or your dress first? And there's really no wrong way. Whenever I get dressed myself, I happen to choose my jewelry first. So I am definitely even outside of that box. But whatever you wear, ever you want to be comfortable in. If you're comfortable, you will exude confidence, and that's always the best, to me, ingredient in any outfit.
Okay, but advice on picking the hat.
You know, being a judge, I want to stay neutral and say that whatever you choose to express yourself, I love to see individuality. And yesterday I was talking to someone about this, and I talked about that I like to see creativity. So if I see something original, that gets me really excited. And I feel pretty confident in saying that Donna and April would probably agree with me that we really want to see originality.
Let's forget about the event tomorrow and really just think about the style that people are trying to evoke. Because people are going to be going to Derby watch parties, not just at the Kansas City
everywhere.
Museum.
All across
town, at their friends' houses,
it's
at bars.
Right.
So let's just think about the style itself and that look. So we've talked a little bit about the hat.
Right.
Gloves, that's another accessory that in 2018, a lot of us are not accustomed
may
to wearing.
May not have a pair of gloves.
And may not know how to do it right. Like, I grew up in the era of scrunchies. I know how to do a scrunchie. I did not grow up in the era of gloves. I am likely to screw that up. So help me.
Oh, all you have to do is just slide your hand into them, and there's no wrong.
No. You skipped
there's
a
no
lot of steps.
There's no wrong when it comes to dressing. There's no wrong. But definitely, back to fashion, now we finally have ended winter. Spring is upon us. Yesterday, I spent a little moment with a bunch of tulips in a flower bed, and it got me so excited to see what choices people will make when they wear to the Derby. And I anticipate seeing a lot of bright pastel colors, a lot of fun, flowy dresses, and things that are happy. So I think I'm really excited to see all that.
If someone is going around looking for items that might make good derby wear, can you talk a little bit more about the time period that we're referencing and what the time period and the region that we're referencing, like this look and what people, what you might need, how to find it in Kansas City?
Sure. Well, we are really, really lucky here in Kansas City as there's so much fashion. And furthermore, I will say that there's no rules in dressing for the Derby. I was looking through pictures earlier this week, and I saw a lovely picture of a woman in a pantsuit. So you definitely, there's no rules. Someone was asking me yesterday, what's the proper dress code and everything? And I think that you want to look nice and neat, but really have fun with your fashion choices. It really comes down to personal taste and aesthetic. Now, if you're shopping in Kansas City, there's so many different stores. As I said, we're really, really blessed here in Kansas City with a lot of retail options, new or used, vintage, contemporary. It really comes down to your personal taste and aesthetic. And I love shopping here in Kansas City. There's so many wonderful places.
Does horse racing have anything to do with this?
Sure. It's fun. It's fun to see any kind of contest, competition, whether it be sporting, athletes, or horses. And it's a very old, I think this is the 144th year of the Kentucky Derby. So it's really fun. So the horses are a component, but really it's socialization. Seeing your friends and engaging in a party, it's always fun.
How did you get into fashion?
Well, that's a funny story. So when I was a little boy, I have three older sisters, and they were a little older than me. So I spent most of my childhood watching them get ready for dances and dates. They were very popular girls. So most of my childhood was spent watching three beautiful women getting ready. And then I also have a grandma who, she was head of the accessories department at Crosby's department store from 1960 to 1970. So when I got old enough to have, you know, more mature conversations with my grandma, she really enjoyed telling me stories about that time period in her life. So that is definitely like, I credit my passion for fashion to my grandma.
So as we get ready for this day where even people who aren't usually particularly into fashion, right, or into throwback fashions, right, get into it for the day, for this event.
Yeah, I mean, and don't be afraid to express your own personal taste and identity. I really refrain from saying there's a dress code. You want to look nice. You want to present yourself in the best light. But I hate saying that there's rules when it comes to fashion. I love originality, individuality, and self-expression in fashion always. And I appreciate it. Maybe not everybody else will agree with me, but that's my own personal opinion.
Yeah. What will you be wearing tomorrow?
Well, you'll have to show up. I'll see you there.
And can you tell me just how a julep fits into this particular style? A julep in hand?
I think a julep always fits into any scenario. I'm never opposed to a concoction.
Well, Andrew Gabler, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Andrew is judging two contests tomorrow at the Kansas City Museum's Kentucky Derby Watch Party, Best Dressed and Best Hat. There's also a derby party at Julep, the Westport bar whose namesake is the drink the derby is kind of known for. And there are lots of other places throwing derby parties, too. You can use this fashion advice at any one of them. That is a wrap. Today's show will be archived at kcur.org. That's where you can find anything you might have missed throughout the week, like yesterday's show about Janelle Monáe, her music, her story, her persona, and what it all means to some amazing women living here in Kansas City. kcur.org/centralstandard. Stay in touch with us on Twitter over the weekend. We are at @KCURCST. This show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Coy Duggar, and Suzanne Hogan, with help from intern Matt Groby. Linda Scher runs the board for us every day, and our theme music is by Spoonbender Labs. I'm Gina Kaufman. Have fun out there, and stick around for Up to Date next.